Is a theory pure or applied mathematics? Refers to a particular application of said theory that is outside of mathematics and that I will discuss today. It's outside of metaphysics as well, outside of those applications that we have been seeing in the rest of the talks. And this application raises a question of the power of said theory as an ontology. And I'm going to discuss that a little bit. And then I'm going to come to a mathematical part, which has to do with something called the index of absoluteness, which I'm going to introduce. So this talk was inspired by reading this book. This is a recent book by Alain Badiou called The Immanence of Truths. And those of you who know Badiou probably know that this is a continuation of his engagement with mathematics. But if you haven't heard of Badiou's work, I'm going to tell you a little bit about that. And in fact, this book, in a way, closes a circle of his engagement with the higher infinite, set theory, category theory, forcing, and large cardinals. And all of these notions form a part of his tool case, as it were. Badiou is not a mathematician, and he is not proving new theorems in mathematics. This is not where his impact lies. He uses mathematics to explain certain concepts in philosophy, and the main mathematical tool that he has is set theory. So in a sense, Badiou is just the opposite of me. I'm interested in philosophy because I think that the best theorems in mathematics are inspired by good philosophical questions. So in mathematics, we have all kinds of levels of theorems. And after you pass that first hurdle of being able to prove one theorem, then you realize that you can prove maybe 15 others in exactly in the same way, or somehow, you know, by changing an epsilon. And you know, you can, like this, go through your PhD thesis many years, and then, you know, if you haven't been careful, you're going to dry out because your advisor's idea to give you this problem is going to dry out after your 15 papers and you're stuck. So this is not a good way to do mathematics. A better way to do mathematics is to ask yourself why this question that I want to be spending some time on is actually interesting. And philosophy helps us in that, and it has always been behind my interest in philosophy. But let us now talk about the book. The book says the third volume of the Lettre et l'Evénement, the being and the event. Some of you might have read this book. It is quite a well-known book that was published earlier on. And this is the first time where Badiou had used set theory. And interestingly enough, at least for me, I've been doing set theory for many years now, and I'm quite engaged in the set theoretic community. I feel that not many people in our community have actually engaged with this application of set theory, if it were. So it's perhaps I'm going to give you a little crash course on this in case that you haven't seen it before. So the plan of this talk is we start with a crash course on Badiou and his philosophy. Then we do a quick reflection on applicability of set theory. Do we agree or do we disagree with this way of using set theory? And then actually we get inspired by Badiou's ideas to define something in mathematics and to talk about mathematical concepts. That's the plan. So let's go through the hard part first. Philosophy of Badiou. He is an amazing philosopher with a lot of philosophical background. He is an avid reader of Platon and translator of Platon. He is somebody who uses philosophy of the past in his everyday philosophical discourse, but he is also somebody who is a very engaged in bringing philosophy close to the general public. In fact, he defines his work through the four pillars. The four pillars of his philosophy are love, politics, science, and art. And when we say love here, we do not only mean love between two individuals, we also mean love of certain ideas. We mean engagement in things that we believe in. Politics, what's his engagement in politics? He is one of the main figures of May 68. May 68 in France stands for a Velvet Revolution that happened at that time. 68 was, of course, an important year in many countries where young people stood up to change things. It was important in the United States, but in France, instead, when you say May 68, you somehow associate a complete breakout of certain bourgeois values and, a liberal view that has been instated with more or less success since that time. And Badiou was one of the main figures in that. Science. So Badiou, as I said, is somebody who follows a classical tradition in philosophy, starting from the old Greeks, and he believes very much, like they did, in the engagement between philosophy and science, in particular mathematics. And he's somebody who has read a lot of mathematics and has understood a lot of mathematics. I noticed, for example, that the multiverse is a very popular subject in this audience. So I think he has understood this multiverse better than a large number of mathematicians. So because of his political ideas, Badiou has many detractors, and you know, everybody has their own point of view. But those who say that his ideas are not good because he didn't understand the mathematics that he's talking about are wrong. This is not true. And let me also speak a little bit about the fourth pillar, which is art. He has engaged in person with many aspects of art, poetry, play. He has written plays, he has written novels, and he has inspired others in the world of culture to consider set theory, believe it or not, as an inspiration in their art. So I can mention this seminar, Mamoufi, which means mathematics, music, and philosophy, which has been running in Paris for the last at least 30 years, which is run by François Nicolas, who is a composer. And he wrote books on forcing, to explain forcing to his colleagues, musicians. So to me, this was all very new. I don't know if it is to you, but to me, it was very interesting to find that people in the art community are so inspired by these ideas that they got from Badiou, actually, initially. So I'll tell you why. Why this idea of set theory and infinity is so important for Badiou's philosophy. And we shall, as I say, try to gain something out of this philosophy to bring it back to set theory and ask some interesting questions. So, the promised crash course. So, Badiou is, I think, recently I spoke about this in a seminar that was in France, so everybody there knew Badiou and nobody knew Schellach. And I introduced Schellach to them by saying, well, Schellach is sort of our Badiou. He writes a lot, and not everything of it is easy to understand. So to this audience, I will introduce Badiou. I'll say that Badiou is like Schellach. He's somebody who publishes a lot of books, papers, everything. He's everywhere at the same time. And so, yes, it is not always easy to follow everything that he does, but of the large books, the size of this one, he wrote four books. The first one was The Theory of Subject in 1982. And, what is in The Theory of Subject? It's a book in which Very firmly, he affirms that we do not need the divinity in order to have a subject that operates. So he takes a very, very humanistic position in which the human or the collective is in the center of the action. And this is a position that he has defended throughout his work, and you will see how set theory actually enters into that position. So the first time that he speaks of set theory is in his second book, which is Le Être et l'Événement, so the being and the event. And well, the name of this book is a bit of a play of words to the philosophy of Sartre. Sartre wrote a book, Lettre et le Néant. So Néant means negation somehow, nothing exists. There is no event because there is only the being. And this book is an answer to that by introducing the event, the action. And so what is happening? If you declare that there is no superior being, then you may easily think that everything has a very temporal value. Everything that is created by human beings. Human beings are there for a limited amount of time. And, well, so nothing really has a value. That's one way of seeing things. But he is very against this, and he gives an answer to this by making set theory the ontology, so there is no divinity, but there is a structure to the universe. So he sees the universe of set theory as something that encompasses the events. And then he sees the models of the inside of this big universe. He sees the models that are touched by the events, and these events are the generic extensions. So in this book, published in 1988 by somebody who is not doing set theory, we have this universe and multiverse view that has been discussed so much in our discussions, which came much later. So he has this completely, in my opinion, right way of seeing things, that there is a universe, and within the universe, there is the multiverse of the small models. So then, of course, he becomes aware that there are parts of mathematics even which you cannot express by set theory. There is category theory, which can be somehow interpreted in set theory using large cardinals. But on the face of it, category theory is a different way of foundations of mathematics. So he writes another book, which is The Logic of the World, published in 2005, in which he talks about category theory. And for him, category theory is understood as the as fixing a subject by the relations that this subject has with other members of the community or within the rest of the physical world. So you see, this fits very much his ideas of the collective. So there is the subject, but there is also the relations. And these are, of course, the objects and the morphisms that we have in category theory. And then the book that we have here in front of us, which was published in 2018. And so what he does in all his work is to have a battle against relativization. That is, universal truths with an S exist. There is a more than one truth, but the truths are universal. Once you have a truth, then it remains a truth. And his favorite example, of course, the Euclidean geometry. It's true. Even though we have non-Euclidean geometry, it's a different truth, but both of them are true. And the truth is created. It is created by the human subject. It's a product which is immanent in a given world. And this is how you see in this interpretation a world which is a model of set theory, the way that he describes it, and then you have a product, which is a generic extension. So this is how he writes it. I wrote it in French, I will translate it. the truths are created by a human subject, personal or impersonal human subject, individual or collective, in the worlds which are determined with determined world materials. So this argument is at the same time against two things: the dogmatic position that the truths are eternal and determined by a transcendental and external figure, and the relativist position that there are no universal truths. Everything is relative. So by using this analogy with set theory and large cardinals, he arrives to resolve this argument. So I hope that I have interested you enough to read this if you haven't already, but let me move closer to why we are talking about this book. Let us talk about the infinite. Why is he so interested in the infinite, and what does the infinite represent for him? So the idea of the infinite is something that's neither finite nor transcendental. Yesterday we had a lot of discussion about how you can do certain things for every ordinal, but you cannot do that same thing for all the ordinals at once. So you cannot take the constructible universe, the cumulative hierarchy, and put the same construction again on top of all the ordinals, because you have finished with the ordinals. This is actually the difference between the infinite and the transcendental. The infinite, the ordinals are infinite because they are not finite, but they are not transcendental. Transcendental is something that surpasses all creation. So Bourdieu is actually studying the infinite because this transcendental in his philosophy represents the divinity, the supreme being, and the finite represents those relativists who feel that everything, that we are totally ruled by finite parameters and that we cannot exit our finiteness. So this is what he calls the doctrine of finiteness. This doctrine of finiteness says that the human being is completely reducible to a finite set of parameters. So he's against this, and for him the truths are universal and they are an infinite resource. So even though every human being is finite in his finite time, the humanity is not finite. The humanity is infinite. And as I mentioned, the transcendental is about the figure of God, an external force which determines the world. So this infinite comes as the liberating force in this philosophy. It is the liberating force of the infinite is to give you an ontology and universality, but that it can be handled through the multiplicity of elements. You don't need the supreme being. And now, what's finite for Bourdieu? It's not really finite. So I gave a talk in front of him and, you know, teased him a little bit about how finite in mathematics actually happens to be quite complicated, and that we have quite a lot of interesting problems that we have no idea how to resolve, even though they're finite, etc. And so we had a discussion, and in fact, the finite in his work is not really finite. It is more than finite, constructive. Constructive from an individual, like a constructive set, L. So defined, algorithmic, this is what finite means in his work. How does absoluteness enter into this? So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about this last book. The last book is mostly about large cardinals, and it has to do with, it was inspired actually by Wooden's work on generic absoluteness. So why does absoluteness interest Bourdieu's philosophy? So let us go back to Spinoza. Spinoza was one of the classical philosophers who was very mathematical. He wrote his books in terms of theorems and conclusions, and he argued logically. So in his book Ethics, he established the following: every finite thing operates within a finite time and within a finite zone, within a finite zone of influence. And then it influences another finite thing, and so on to the infinite. So you see in Spinoza's, he calls it theorem 28 in his book one, you can see here this idea of potential infinity as people had at the time. This is much before Cantor. And then this proof that this is how finite beings operate actually needs an assumption. And the assumption is the singular being, which is not finite. The proof doesn't work otherwise. And whose existence can be proved if one believes in substance. So this is how Spinoza formulated this. Spinoza was actually very atheist. So he would never use the word God. But he believed in this substance, this external being, which in practical use has the attributes of God. So Bourdieu wants to get out of this use of the singular being. So he wants to get out of the God, and without postulating that God exists, he just says we exist. So we are in this universe. We have a universe of sets, and he works in we. So rather than postulating God, he postulates the set theory with the existence of various infinities, and he works in we. Now, when I say we, I do not say we that can be now further extended by some generic extension. I want to emphasize that even though in set theory we sometimes make an abuse of notation and we write vp for a generic extension of some model, and we say let v be a model, actually the forcing methodology does not work on all v. You cannot force on v. What you can force upon is some small model, which careful writers such as Kuhnen would denote by M, to make you all the time aware that in order to extend M, to have some generic extension, you actually have to be inside of some V. Otherwise, the forcing theorem doesn't make any sense. So V that Bourdieu means is this V. It is not one of those small models and their generic extensions. Therefore, rather than God, it's the structure of the set theoretic universe which gives the ontology. Now, I drew a line here because, of course, all of this has some limitations. I personally do not believe that in foundations of mathematics we have yet found the ontology. And even more so, I don't even believe that the ontology exists. I think that set theory is a wonderful way of handling a large part of mathematics. It is, to some extent, if you admit large cardinals, interchangeable with category theory, although one would be mad to be doing theorems in algebraic topology using set theory rather than category theory. There are natural contexts in which one expresses oneself. And there are parts of mathematics where set theory simply does not apply. If you are interested to argue in intuitionistic logic, well, ZFC set theory is not going to help you because it's written in classical logic. And intuitionistic logic is important in mathematics because of the Curry-Howard correspondence that gives a translation between formulas in this logic and, well, other objects. Never mind. In computer sciences, which are an important part of mathematics, set theory is actually too big a measure. Even first-order logic is too big a measure if you want to say anything useful to computer scientists. You have to work in a fragment of first-order logic. First-order logic for computer scientists is like transcendental to set theorists. It's something you don't work with because it's too big. So I do not believe that set theory is the ontology, but I quite like, I certainly believe that is the ontology for a large part of mathematics. I'm interested in that part of mathematics. And as well, I would not say that set theory describes the entire life, because it doesn't even describe the entire mathematics. But I like these metaphors that Bourdieu has used to describe everyday objects in everyday events in terms of set theory. And well, as I say, we are going to talk about something he discusses that inspired some set theoretical questions. Let me, now that I have kind of told you in big lines how he imagines this application of set theory, let me give you some examples of how he does it. So how does he apply set theory? Now, this you may or may not agree with, and this is, now we are moving from pure philosophy to applied philosophy to politics. So I'm giving his examples, which are quite wild. Well, that's why I like. So how does Badiou understand Cantor's theorem that the number of subsets of the set is strictly larger than the number of elements of the set? That's quite easy. An element is an individual. A subset is a collectivity. So if you look at the collective impact of a certain set of objects, that is going to be much bigger than the impact of the sum of those individuals who are not collaborating to each other. That is one way of understanding that. What's a proof by contradiction? Why there are certain things like this theorem that inspired him a lot need a contradiction to be proved? Well, because the thought that is algorithmic and finitistic cannot reach the grounds that are needed in the infinite. So when subjected to the infinite, the thought cannot be exclusively algorithmic. One cannot reason just by putting one foot in front of another. One has to necessarily be dialectic and has to reason in terms of a roadmap and possible obstacles to that roadmap. So a proof of contradictions like that. How about the Russell paradox? Well, I'm sure you've got this one already. This is like the best proof that there is no God. I mean, there's no God, there is no universal set, there is no supreme being, doesn't exist. Generic extension. Didn't I mention May 68? That was a revolution. This is a revolution without blood. Generic extension is a revolution on a model, and it preserves things that we want to preserve, and it builds some other things that before that we could name, but we couldn't have. So these are examples. Now, we have to understand all of this metaphorically. Even with things that we have seen yesterday in the conference, as you could see, the set theory members of the audience were somewhat uneasy to understand literally some of the things that more philosophical talks involved, because we are not thinking in terms of metaphors. So when you try to formalize something, that shouldn't be a metaphor, that should be a proof. Well, Badiou doesn't formalize, he uses the formalization as a metaphor. So I think this is completely, completely legitimate. But we have to be careful, because a literal application of the mathematical of this is actually gives you a contradictory mathematical theory. And I'm going to give you an example of that. Well, my example is going to be somewhat abstract. If you are interested to see a translations of the abstract objects that are mentioned in this in that very nice conference that was organized in June in Mamoufi, where I spoke about this in front of Badiou, I actually gave some concrete meanings to the letters that were going to be presented in the next slides. If you are curious, go and see the film. But we are going to remain on the scientific, because that conference had some political meaning to it as well, and this one doesn't, so we're going to stay within the realms of symbols. So I'm going to show you how you're going easily to get a contradiction if you take this philosophy as a mathematical theory. So here is something that appears a lot in his work. It's ultrafilters. So the whole book is about, this book is about large cardinals. So the bread and butter of large cardinals is an ultrafilter, which allows you to make the following picture. You have your V. Now this V is, well, this V And inside of this V sits a cardinal kappa, which is a large cardinal whose existence we postulate. It's a measurable cardinal. And once the measurable cardinal actually is, the measure means there is some way of measuring subsets of this cardinal. There is an ultra filter, so it's a set of subsets, and those sets that are in the ultra filter are considered big. So this exists already on omega, but the ones that we use on a measurable cardinal have some further properties which allow V to kind of collapse into a subclass of itself, which is called M. In a sense, it's a collapse because it's a subclass of V, but in another sense, it is sort of an upgrade because this kappa gets moved to an ordinal. So this V is also, M is also a model of enough of set theory, but this kappa moves to a bigger ordinal than itself, so it somehow it reaches higher grounds. And this is, measurable cardinals are kind of the smallest, large cardinals. That is, they are, you know, close to being the smallest object that cannot exist in L. They are not, but they are, if you want to do combinatorial set theory with large cardinals, these are very basic things. So anyway, that's why Badiou talks a lot about ultra filters. And what he does in this book is something that we never do in set theory. He actually tries to explain higher set theory to the general public. So this is very, very nice, actually. And so he takes his time. That's why the book is so fat. When people ask me if I read this book, I said I read it before it was written, because much of it is actually explaining set theory. And I like it very much. And it's useful to explain it to people. So how does he explain the ultra filter? So let me just remind you what an ultra filter is, in case that, you know. So as I say, to make this kind of embedding, you need an ultra filter. So an ultra filter is a subset of all the family of all subsets of kappa. And it has the property that it is a maximal filter. So every set is either in or out. Okay, thank you. Thanks a lot. So it's a maximal filter, and a filter means somehow a family of big sets. So if you take of the real numbers, measure one sets in the interval are big sets, and they form a filter. Now, this ultra filter for measurable cardinals has further properties, but somehow the point is it contains sets with the majority inside. And he wants to explain that using an example from politics. So his example is the region of Yunnan in China. So he is very involved in Chinese politics. And this region of Yunnan had a stormy history in which, at the end of the story, it became or remained in the power of the People's Republic of China. And this is what Badiou says. This region has stayed in the People's Republic despite the division inflicted to China by Chiang Kai-shek and the Japanese invaders. And why has it stayed in the Popular Republic of China? Because the majority of people wanted it. So the ultra filter that is used in this particular application is the majority of people. So any set that has the majority is in the ultra filter. So I have this little example to show that if you take this literally, you're going to get contradictions. So as I said, I'm doing this with some shorthand. We are going to talk about the country Y. And this country Y is divided into seven regions. One of these regions is called C. And on the timeline of this country, the history of the relation between Y and C is kind of time dependent. So this is Y and this is C. Okay, I'm not going to draw any maps. So in 1980, C enters Y from some previous history. And however, in 1941, she chooses a very, let us say, strange government led by P. And P claims that the majority of people in C wants to leave Y. And it's ready to pay any price, and he pays a very high price. So C is no longer in Y. Now P loses in 1945, so C enters Y. And there is another government now called T. And T claims that the majority of C wants to stay inside of Y. That's why it stays in Y. And then the history goes back in 1991. C chooses another government, which is very similar to the one that was called P, now we'll call it P2. So P2 has the same sort of story as P, and C leaves Y. So you see, this is a real historical example, which shows you that the two majorities that were mentioned by P and T do not have an intersection. There is an empty intersection between those that want to leave Y and those that want to stay in Y. And this cannot happen in a filter. So it's a contradiction. And the contradiction is, of course, there because in real life, things happen during time. So in one given time, the majority there will be only one majority. But if you look at the history, and that is the history that determines how our political life, you will actually not be able to argue just on the basis of majority. You have to take some other elements into account. So this is a very simple example, which shows that if you apply this Badiou philosophy too literally, then it is not going to give mathematical satisfaction. And therefore, it is not there to be taken purely mathematically. It's there to be taken as an inspiration. And on the pure side of it, it is very logical. And I personally find it very beautiful. And as I said, I don't believe in the ontological interpretation of set theory. And I believe that this attempt to use set theory as an applied science is covered by thorns. This artwork by Ada van den Broek, my daughter, shows a rose. A rose has thorns. So there are many thorns if you try to apply set theory, but I do not think that should stop us. I mean, why not? Perhaps not by the same set of people. Because you know, if there are some people who prove theorems and who are very much into that and who will be looking for contradictions and ultra filters that don't intersect, and the others who will do something more imaginative or the imaginative in a different way. And okay, so why not apply set theory? There are people who apply complex analysis to argue about tsunamis and they get much funding about this. So what's wrong about applying set theory? Ad esperam per astram, through thorns to the sky, to the stars. So let us then leave the future of set theory as applied mathematics to some other future, perhaps, set theorists. But the old guard will still be looking at the pure aspects. So since I'm in the old guard, let me talk a little bit about how all of this inspired me to think of some things in set theory. So I want to talk about this idea that appears in the Badiou's book. It's called the index of absoluteness. So the whole starts with the wooden idea of generic absoluteness. Well, this wooden, of course, has made much work on it, but this idea was in set theory by others, including Johan, by many mathematicians work on this idea of generic absoluteness, somehow a universe that is immune to generic, to certain generic extensions or some formulas which are rendered indestructible by generic extensions. And so Badiou interprets this as the essential truth. A formula is essentially true if it, it remains true in the generic extensions. So it's more than just being true. It's not true just for a given time. It's true forever. Once it's true, it remains true. So he actually wants to use this to distinguish the art, the values of a piece of art. What distinguishes an immortal piece of art from one which is just there for the popularity? And so he uses now large cardinals and the picture that we have already there. So he understands V as the absolute and M as some sort of attribute of the absolute. So something is eternal if it has even for a, so let us just say the large cardinals provide a point of contact of the absolute with one of its attributes. And well, this is how he defines what eternal art is. This is what leads him to the concept, the index of absoluteness. He specifically states that this index is not to be applied to mathematics, because mathematics is eternal by its construction. Whatever was proved by the old Greeks is still true. So it is, there is no index, it's there forever. But he wants to use this idea to talk about art. So he talks about some pieces of art that have achieved immortality. These are the oeuvre d'art, and they are opposed to the consumables, to the vase, the dishes. So how to distinguish them is the point of the last part of this book. And the answer is that oeuvre have reached, even for a brief moment, one of the attributes of the absolute. They have been in the generic extension. Okay, so this is all very beautiful. And you know, I am always very, very impressed by people who have such a large, infinitely large general culture that they can talk about all of these things with equal assurance. And still, I was wondering, can I say something mathematically about this? So, even though Badiou says that we cannot, let's try. Okay, so let's try to do something about the index of absoluteness in mathematics. What does this remind me of? We're going to think, what does this look like in mathematics? Well, let's see. So I am in total agreement with Badiou that when it comes to the impossibility to assign a temporal index of absoluteness to mathematical theorems. So a theorem is a theorem, and as long as you believe in the same axiomatic system, you're not going to change it. However, we can assign a spatial index of absoluteness, and it has to do with this picture. It has to do with this generic absoluteness. So we have already seen that the spatial index of absoluteness actually exists. You can look at the formulas with respect to their indestructibility by forcing. So let me give you some examples of the work that have already been done on that and is known. So, for example, some statements are absolute to all models of set theory. Delta zero statements, bounded quantification, whatever you can say in that way, is going to be true in all models of set theory. So if you want, it has an infinite index of absoluteness. Some statements are known to be absolute to generic extensions. For example, think of the Schoenfield absoluteness theorem. Let me say that even though the only way that we know for this moment to go from one universe of set theory to another constructively is forcing, this doesn't mean that the only way to extend one universe to another is forcing. There could be, for all we know, some other methods, and there could be many universes that are not forcing extensions of one another, just living happily within the big universe. So it being absolute to generic extensions is weaker, potentially than being absolute, not potentially, truly weaker than being absolute to everything. Now, some objects or statements are known to be absolute to generic extensions unless there are large cardinals. For example, there is this very well-known and beautiful theorem of Jensen, which is called the covering lemma, and which tells you that unless in your V you have some large cardinals, then all subuniverses of V are going to agree with the spine of V. The spine of V is L. It's in everything. L is in every, it's a unique L. And L has some opinions, and the Jensen covering lemma says that unless there is a large cardinal in V, then all the universes are approximated by L. For example, the singular cardinal hypothesis, which says that the values of the continuum function at the singular cardinal are determined by the values on the cardinals below, is true. So this is objects. It has a large index of absoluteness, but you see kind of smaller than the index of absoluteness of these things that are true in all generic extensions, because you have to assume that there is no large cardinal. Then some objects are indestructible by mouth forcing. For example, CCC indestructible objects have been studied by many people, but I think the first person who had this idea to actually use them in a proof of something was Ken Kuren, who studied indestructible indestructible gaps by CCC forcing. And using this, he proved the theorem, which still hasn't been surpassed and provides a nice open question. He proved that the first cardinal Vermartin axiom fails can be singular. Notably, it can be Aleph Omega 1. But we do not know if this cardinal can be another singular cardinal. We don't know. This theorem from the 1980s is still the best. So it's obtained by studying these gaps that are not destroyed by CCC forcing. So you see that somehow, heuristically, we have already been doing this index of absoluteness. But how do we make this formal? How absolute a statement is, and to give it a measure as an index of absoluteness. Actually, a proto-idea of doing this appears in our own work with Sharon Shelah. And I believe that this is, to my knowledge, the first time that people have tried to classify objects using generic extensions. So to show you this, let me show you first an artwork by Joanna Kania Bartoszynska and Tomek Bartoszynski, who made the following picture as a birthday present, part of the birthday present, film that they realized for their three-year-old grandson. So you see, what you see here is something that resembles to the classification of species. But this is actually classifications of first-order theories, according to the classification theory of Shelah. So one important line in this classification is the line of stable theories. Here we have stable theories, things that are even more stable than stable, super stable, and so forth. And this line of stability is something that is a very big dividing line in this classification. What does it mean to classify first-order theories? Why is stability so nice? Actually, this is a completely wild thing that was done by Sharon, being inspired by theorems of Morley. So this is already in his PhD thesis. He worked on this problem. The idea is, you look at the first order theory T. Let us say it's complete, countable first order theory. And let us just take some examples. It could be the theory of random graphs, the theory of dense linear order with no endpoints, something like that, okay? So you have hundreds of theories like that, and you would somehow like to classify them into theories which are simpler than others by some criteria that's important to you. So the criteria that was very much important in model theory and was studied there is to this theory you associate something that could be called the spectrum of T. The spectrum of T is the set of all cardinals lambda which are uncountable, and such that at this cardinal lambda the theory has the maximal possible number of non-isomorphic models, which is 2 to the lambda. So I of T at lambda, the number of non-isomorphic models, of size lambda, you want it to be 2 to the lambda, so the biggest possible. And it turns out, so you're looking here at the class of cardinals. Look, this is not something set theory does very often. You look at a class of cardinals, and you want to distinguish theories by looking at the class that they give rise to. And the magic thing is that this stability line offers you an entry into what is called Shellac's main gap theorem, which says that theories either have this spectrum contain only very few initial cardinals or all possible cardinals. So this spectrum can only be of two kinds. It's either very small, so it's like an initial segment of the all cardinals, these are the cardinals, or it's everything. Okay? For example, for linear orders, it is everything. For algebraically closed fields, it's nothing. So it's either very small or everything. And to know in which part you fall, you will use this idea of stability. Well, it's a little bit more complicated, but we are not giving all the details. And what's magic about this is that stability can be witnessed by something called the ranks, which is completely describable within ZFC. So there is no forcing, nothing here. It is all ZFC, even though it's a class of cardinals. So it's totally magic. Okay, but it only gives you some part of this map. So in the 90s, we started working on the other part of that map, which is this part here. So this is where Sahron and I worked, and we wanted to distinguish theories for which we know they are unstable, but can they be less unstable than the others? You see, so the linear order is kind of the max. It's like here, and we were able to put the triangle free graphs here, to put some other natural theories in these lines. How did we do that? Well, we look at not to this spectrum, we look at to the universality spectrum. So let me just write to you what the universality spectrum is. So just to remind you, a universal model of some theory is a model in which all the other models embed the same cardinal. So for example, you have the rationals are universal linear order which is countable. So you have one guy and everybody else embeds into it. So if you have GCH, the universal models exist for all theories like this at every uncountable cardinal. So in GCH, this universality cannot be used to classify. So what we did is to look at these relative universality spectrums, which depend on the model where you find yourself. And so we look at the universality spectrum of the theory where the universality number is equal to 1. That it means there exists 1. And this depends on M. So we ask, can we make this universality spectrum equal to 1 and fail GCH? Because if you have GCH, then you know it's too easy. So plus not GS, GCH. And then we classify theories according to how easy it is to make such models. So basically, for linear orders, it's impossible. And for triangle-free graphs, it's okay. For the random graph, it is well known that you can do this with a CCC forcing even. So with a nice forcing. So you see, we had this idea, which is an index of absoluteness. So this is really, you know, Shellac's pioneering idea of classification, using anything in your hand, enters into this project. It started already in the early 90s. It's to classify unstable theories according to how easy it is for them to have a universal model in generic extensions which violate GCH. So let me then say there are other things that have some index of absoluteness. One of them is PCF theory. So if you have heard of PCF theory, it's also by Shellac. It's an introduction of some new operations on cardinals which allow us to talk about singular cardinals with, it allows us to talk about singular cardinals not just with respect to their power set operation, but some other operations which turn out to be almost intouchable by forcing. There was actually this big conjecture that you cannot change the size of a PCF of a countable set. Well, it turns out that conjecture was wrong. If you want somebody to kill something by forcing, this is a man you need to call. This is Motti Gitak. And he was able to solve this really hard problem, the Shellac's weak hypothesis, which has to do with this PCF. But still, PCF seems to have a very high index of absoluteness, even though it's not completely untouchable. So just not to give a heart attack to Neil, I'm going to make a conclusion. So in my conclusion, I believe that this idea of the index of absoluteness is something that has implicitly appeared in mathematics and now can be explicitly named after this lecture of, after this reading of philosophy. It's quite nice to put this together, and I'm sure that now that it has been named somewhat more precisely, it will develop to a major classifying method in logic. So thank you very much.